This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 5th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Now, today I'm joined in the studio by Kaleem Aftab, film writer for the Independent newspaper here in London. He'll be talking me through a handful of films today, from the comedy Spy to family drama Second Coming, ending with the indie flick Listen Up, Philip. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. And a very warm welcome to the show, Kaleem. Let's start with the new film from Paul Feig, most known for the breakout comedy hit Bridesmaid. Now, the title Spy is a bit of a giveaway, but can you colour in the story for us first?
Yeah, for sure. The story starts with Jude Law playing a James Bond-type spy and Melissa McCarthy, who was the star of Bridesmaids in many ways, even though she was a side character. She obviously called out the air marshal and became an international superstar. She plays the Miss Moneypenny type figure. She talks in his ear. She tells him what to do. Jude Law is the action hero. She has a thing for Jude Law. Obviously, Jude Law sees Melissa McCarthy, doesn't have a thing for her, but, you know, crushes are fine. Then we see Jude Law get trapped and he gets taken away. I don't want to give away too much, but Melissa McCarthy is then forced into action and forced into being a CIA agent and chasing down the East European bad guys.
Now, references obviously to James Bond. Is there a lot of fun irony, or are we hit over the head with it?
It's not quite as far as Austin Powers type spoof, but it's more like a Casino Royale where there's a funny joke about someone who doesn't look like a spy being a spy. But for my money, it sometimes got a bit too close to the bone. Like, you can look at Melissa McCarthy, and yes, obviously she's unique in Hollywood because she's a more round star than others. She's also over 40, which is great. But then, to make this point, which I think Paul Feig is, about how society views certain people, he sometimes does it so much that instead of elucidating the problem, he kind of adds to it.
Well, let's have a little listen to the film now.
To another successful mission. I couldn't do what I do without you and my earpiece.
Head down the tunnel. You got three coming in.
Can you imagine me as a spy?
With a gun.
What? These look delicious. Mm. This is very chewy.
You're eating a hand towel.
And that was the sound of a spy. Now, tell me, it sounds fast and furious. Was it?
It was pretty slapdash and pretty fast, if you want to see it that way. But I felt like that was almost the problem with the film, was that Paul Feig couldn't decide if he wanted to make a comedy or if he wanted to make an action thriller with Melissa McCarthy as a CIA agent. When he let Melissa McCarthy do what she does best, which is brilliant one-liners, situational comedy, the film is rip-roarous and funny. But when we see her driving cars or on a scooter, I was just not so enamoured.
In this screening that you were in, were there people laughing? You know, is this a film that a lot of people will find funny? Who will it appeal to?
Well, you know, critic screenings are normally full of people that try their best not to laugh, but there were definitely some belly laughs. And it's a very mass broad appeal. But I think if you went in expecting Bridesmaid or The Heat, you'd be a little bit disappointed because this is far less original. It's also written by Paul Feig, whereas the other two films were written by women, and they gave insights that you don't normally see in cinema, whereas this just felt like more of the same.
And is there a little bit of feminism here or not?
I think there is a little bit of feminism, and one of the key moments of the key parts of this is Rose Byrne, who is absolutely brilliant as the villain. She's very posh, Oxford educated, kind of a trust girl. She's got this nuclear bomb because her father's died. She wants to sell it. It's a very funny situation. She would prefer to wear garish outfits, which she thinks are suitable for the catwalk, than to be a villainous creature. And that's all great. And the riff that she has with Melissa McCarthy is great. There's also a brilliant cameo from Miranda Hart, who takes over as the Moneypenny type figure to Melissa McCarthy's spy. And they're a Laurel and Hardy combination. And that is all really great. And some of those insights are good, but there's not enough of that. And there's too much of action hero spy for my liking.
Well, for some of you who do like a little bit of a giggle with your action movies, do head to the box office to book a couple of hours of lively entertainment with Spy. Now, let's move on to Second Coming, a very different kind of movie to Spy. This is director Debbie Tucker Green's debut film, and it got off to a good start when it was selected to play at the Toronto Film Festival. Kalim, now, can you also set this film up for us?
Second Coming is a reference to Jesus, and the film is about a woman who's having a virgin birth, which sounds enormous and very big, but actually that's hardly mentioned throughout the whole movie. And instead it becomes a very insightful urban domestic drama involving Nadine Marshall, who plays the mother, and Idris Elba, who we all know from The Wire, playing the father to this young 13-year-old. And it's about their relationship and how they cope with a baby that's coming, and also with the fact that no one quite knows who the father is.
Now, why do you think this parable was of interest to Debbie Tucker Green, who is a writer of theatre? What do you think she was trying to explore with this theme?
I think this film is very theatrical, and that's one of the main attributes to it. It's so unusual because it's all about what we don't see, what we aren't told, what we feel. And it's very observational about these characters. We see them at work. Idris Elba works for the trains. He builds tracks. She works in an unemployment office. And we then see them at home and their domestic bliss. I think she's interested in the small things about a marriage inside this whole great high concept film.
And now this is her debut film. So I'm wondering how she tackles the screen as opposed to the stage in terms of cinematography.
I don't think it's more the cinematography I was taken by. It was more the tone of the film. It's very slow moving in the kind of way Bruno Dumont from France is, in that we are breathing with the characters. We're feeling what the characters are feeling. And it's a nuanced type of expression that makes us uneasy as an audience. Some of the time I was watching going, why am I watching this? This is really an overlong scene. It's not telling me much. Yet as it builds up one after the other, I was taken by a sensational sense that I'd seen something new and fresh.
Many elements, a bit like a jigsaw puzzle. Do you think it was perhaps too cryptic, and does she lose the audience partway through?
I don't necessarily say she loses the audience, as in she sometimes pulls the audience in with these fantastical moments. There's, for reasons unknown still to me, there is a few sequences actually, where there's showers that happen inside the house, inside the bathroom. But it's all a little bit, I need a little bit more information to be fully engaged with this film. But what I will say is, after watching it, I've not stopped thinking about it.
Interesting. I gather that she uses a technique of very, very, very long shots. To what effect does that have? And probably quite hard on the actors, which will bring out a different kind of performance, maybe.
I think she is certainly someone who you can see has housed her skill in the theatre. She has big faith in the actors. She has big faith in off-screen space. There's one great scene where the young boy played by Kai Francis-Lewis, JJ, who's their teenage son, you see his reaction to an argument going off screen, and we feel his pain, we feel his angst, we feel all of his emotions, and yet it doesn't really matter what the words are. It's very much the sensation.
Is this, it's social realism. Is it British or is it universal, do you think?
I would say that the way that the characters react and the slice of life that we see is very British, yet the sensibility of the film is more like French cinema. It's a much more tricky cinema than a Ken Loach or a Mike Lee. But it has that same kind of observation on life, and the characters she's interested in are the working class.
Interesting. Well, since its Toronto Film Festival premiere, Second Coming has slowly but surely been finding its way onto cinema screens around the world. So do make sure to check it out. We're now going to end up with Listen Up, Philip, which also premiered at a film festival, this time Sundance Film Festival. And it garnered some excellent reviews from some very spoilt for choice critics. Now, before we hear your thumbs up or thumbs down, let's have a little listen of the film.
Is that the new book?
Yeah. Things are going to be pretty crazy for me after the release. Los Angeles in January, San Francisco, and the whole West Coast thing, really. I'm told to expect big things out there.
You sound like you're bragging.
That's because I am bragging.
I can probably find you a lighter weight jacket.
Let's just keep this jacket on me and take the photograph sooner rather than later. I can't breathe here, and you seem to resent my presence.
Well, you're a cruel, miserable person.
I loved your book. Of course, I had achieved considerably more than you by now.
You'll need a country retreat.
Stay with me.
Rub two sticks together. Make a fire.
I hope this will be good for us, but especially for me.
A clip from the movie Listen Up. Who is the director and what is his film about?
The director is Alex Ross Perry, and he's done a couple of these smaller Sundance-type films. This is very much a Sundance-type film, and I can see why the reviews out of Sundance were good, but I'm not so sure the reviews as it's entering the cinema will be quite as well, or the film will be quite as well received, because although it has that tone and style that we like of American indie cinema, and it has one brilliant character in a very obnoxious Jason Schwartzman, who plays an author whose second book is coming out. He feels like he should be more famous than he is. He lives with his girlfriend, Elizabeth Moss, who was in Mad Men. They have a very strange relationship. The film wants to be like a book, and as it tries to develop its style like a book, it completely lost me.
What does the title Listen Up, Philip refer to?
Well, Philip is the name of the main character, but also a little bit intriguingly, is one of the people he meets is a guy called Ike Zimmerman, who is played by Jonathan Pryce, who's ripping up the screens in Game of Thrones at the moment. But Zimmerman is also a reference to one of the pseudonyms of Philip Roth. So there's kind of a Philip Roth-esque feeling of literary references throughout the whole film.
American indie cinema has many, many, many times used, a struggling author as its central theme. Is there a new take on this?
I don't think there's a new take at all. I think it's the obnoxious guy who we watch. I don't know, Jason Schwartzman, he's brilliant in those Wes Anderson films. This is like his Rushmore character 10 years later on. The first scene, we see him meet up with an ex-girlfriend. He's completely rude to her because she's late. He's rude to his living girlfriend. He goes off to move to take a tenure at a university that's away from New York. Everything is just a little too obnoxious about him. But then the film does a very strange thing halfway through. It then leaves Philip and makes Elizabeth Moss' character the main character. And this is where the film really lost me, because instead of giving her an interesting perspective, she seems to miss Philip in a whiny kind of crying way, and didn't seem in any way real.
I was reading one review where it was described as portrait of an artist as a jerk. it sounds that there is a lot of neurosis in this, a lot of self-obsession, which could get quite irritating. And yet many reviewers have called it joyous.
I think you could only call it joyous if you're taken in with the very opening sequence, or you're taken in with some of the university scenes. I think if you read the tone, if you read the undertone of all these egotistical, they're not even self-effacing. I would love that if they were. They were just completely egotistical, lost in their own world, lost in their own thoughts. I just didn't relate to any of the characters.
And what about New York City? A lot of indie films use New York City as their backdrop. Is this a cinematic or a claustrophobic New York City? How does the town play in the film.
It's definitely a claustrophobic New York City, and I think it's in keeping with a lot of new films whereby New York City is depicted as a place where people are crammed together through the only way they can afford to live in the city is by living on top of each other. You almost feel like the relationship is one of convenience, that they're flatmates rather than lovers, and that's played out in the film, and it's a real comment on how tough life is in New York these days.
Interesting. Well, Listen Up, Philip, has already been released in several countries, including the US, Brazil and France. And after this weekend's opening in the UK, the rest of the world will definitely soon follow. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Kalim Aftab, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. My producer was Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again on Monday for the week's best art exhibitions. But for now, many thanks for listening.